coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back to another Worth Doing Badly with me, Jamie Krieger, David Weber, and Ethan Stoppenhagen. We are making our way through the season of Epiphany, and today we will look at the lessons for the seventh Sunday in the season. And the readings are from Genesis 45, verse 3 to 15, the Psalm is 103, the first 13 verses. The epistle reading is from 1 Corinthians 15, verses 21 through 26, and 30 to 42. And the gospel lesson from Luke 6, verses 27 through 38. We begin with David Weber. David, welcome.
Thank you, Jamie. The seventh Sunday after Epiphany carries forward the Epiphany theme that it is God's intent to use his church to finally effect what the creed calls a Catholic outreach. In other words, the word Catholic means it's universal for all peoples everywhere and for all time. And in this case, the group of people that Christ intends to reach with his radical outreach are enemies. They are the group of people we least are likely to think it's a good idea for Christ to reach out to. But Epiphany is a celebration of this radical outreach of Christ to all nations, and the enemies are part of all nations, all time, everywhere. Now, we have to remind ourselves that 2 weeks ago, Jesus' hometown listeners wanted to kill Jesus because he made clear how radical this outreach was, and they were deeply offended. I think if we're not offended by this Catholic outreach, we haven't quite experienced how radically Jesus' intention is. And nowhere, I think, I'm just speaking for myself, is this offense more existentially experienced than when we are commanded to love our enemies. And that is one kind of love in which you can expect no return. Now, people who write about love say that love is not love if it's somehow not paid back. But the way that Jesus presents the Trinitarian love is it's a love that does not need to be reciprocated. It's a love that first of all comes from the Trinity, in which it is totally defined by giving. God gave his son without any chance, without any hope, without any calculation that it would be directly reciprocated. No, in fact, God gave his son, and the reciprocation was to crucify him. And this becomes the definition of love, which is going to somehow win all nations. Loving the enemy seems absurd and impossible. And yet, one of the oddest things is that Christians, while struggling with it over and over again, will recognize that this is desirable. If somehow you could love your enemies, they would no longer have control over you. If you could actually return love for anger and enmity, that somehow would put a stop to this anger. If somehow love actually, this kind of love was possible, all sorts of good things would follow. Now, So why do we want it? Why do we want to be capable of loving our enemies? And of course, the first answer is because Christ on the cross demonstrated what loving the enemy meant, and he forgave their wickedness and treated it as if it was a weakness that was caused by ignorance, and of course, we may think, okay, Jesus is God. It's possible for him to do that. But the promise is that godlike characteristic, godliness, is actually capable of participating in this kind of love for the enemies. Now, how does it happen? So once we recognize ourselves as once, but no longer Jesus's enemies, then what we keep in mind is that we have personally experienced that kind of the benefits of that love that Jesus gave to us. That's what Paul says to remind us that we were the enemy. And if in fact you see that Jesus' outreach to each of us has made a decisive difference in our lives, then loving the enemy, at least for us, is a good idea. Now, whether we in fact can love the enemy in the way that Jesus did is up for grabs. So it first of all begins with each Christian saying, looking at the benefit that when God gave his beloved son and it resulted in death, that move is what brought us into hope. And so moving out from the cross, this gracious, what I'll call a gift economy, and I should define economy. It doesn't mean just the finances. The Greek word for economy means a way of organizing one's life, particularly a way of organizing one's household. And so what we get from the cross is God intends to introduce into this world a gift economy where things are given without reciprocity. Now, of course, that wouldn't work in banking or business or almost any other place in life. But when it has to do with Jesus's cross, this what the scriptures call grace, this gift economy, this remarkable willingness to love without reciprocity, and without looking for some kind of benefit from our love, is where God intends to expand. That free economy began at the cross, but it's God's total intention that the free economy should be the way that all nations everywhere and for all time are greeted with this gospel. So this text says the free economy practices a mercy. And this mercy is resists judgments and condemnation. And it simply, these judgments and condemnation wrongly presume that all people everywhere are stuck in sin. Now, this idea of having mercy rather than judgment is to wait on God to overcome sin in others' lives as he has done in our lives. Well, we still can't get away from the fact that this gift economy in which you don't look for love to be reciprocated, that when you give material goods, you don't look to have them back, that you treat people with mercy rather than judgment or condemnation. I mean, we can see from the cross, it's costly and dangerous. But again, why is it plausible and desirable? And Luke makes it quite clear is that there is a gratitude. There is a joy that emerges when we're no longer subject to the cost-benefit economy of this world, but when we recognize that we are free from having to worry about consequences and free to simply be grounded in God's love, knowing that this love is what endures forever.
You alluded to it a little bit, but do you think there's ways that this gift economy can actually enter into our material world? Like, in some ways, I think when we think of being generous, we think about doing it spiritually and granting forgiveness and showing love. But do you think there's ways, you know, when dealing with our material possessions and with other people who might not have like we do, that gift economy transfers over? Or should we draw lines?
Oh, no, okay, so yeah, there's so many things. First of all, it's each individual. This is how I'm amazed that in the New Testament, there's so little guidance on how much you should give, right? It's because each individual in relationship to God has to decide how deeply do you want to get in on this gift economy. Now, the one thing which is clear with what the gift economy does is it always keeps you in contact with the needy. The needy are the enemies who cannot reciprocate love for all sorts of reasons. The needy are the people who are materially deprived. And the freedom of grace, the freedom of the gift economy is that you always have a connection to the needy because they are always in need of things. But the only way we can maintain that connection is if we are giving and don't expect anything in return other than, otherwise we'll just be deeply disappointed and resentful and angry that we're not getting our just desserts. So yeah, absolutely. But I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, Ethan, but I don't think I can tell anybody else other than myself how I'm going to participate in this gift economy. And because other people aren't in the same relationships that I am. Other people have a more difficult time or have an easier time giving without reciprocity. I mean, I do know that it's the toughest thing in the world to simply let loose of something and give up absolute control over it and try not to care about whether you get anything back in return. Did you have something in mind, like a concrete practice?
I guess what comes to mind is this idea that, well, we have so much abundance and we surround ourselves with other people who have everything that they could need and then some, so that there's this lack of proximity to people who are actually in need, such that they're actually out of our minds, or we, instead of actually giving directly to people in need, we give to organizations who give to people in need.
Yeah,
and that degree of separation in some ways isn't as helpful. It doesn't, like you emphasize, it doesn't put us in direct contact with those people who are in need every day.
Yeah. Yeah. There's all sorts of things that come rushing. So I'll pick out one of them. One of the concepts in the Old Testament that I'm sure I'm going to get wrong is the idea of an offering to express one's gratitude. So the way that I've been interpreting it is there are moments in which I don't have to fake it. I am completely grateful. And, from the guidance from the Old Testament, the way to express that gratitude is to give something away. So let me give you a concrete example. I spent 25 days in the UK enjoying some wonderful moments in Cambridge. Thank you, Jamie. And when I returned home, the front door of my house was open in the middle of winter. And the heater was going crazy. It was 11 degrees. The house was set for 50 degrees. And all I could think about is how many thousands of dollars I owed the power company, not knowing how long the door had been open. So we spent time looking at what the possible damage could be. And I had in my mind it would be something like $5,000 that I would owe because of the stupidity of not deadbolting the door. And then yesterday I got the bill and it was only $350. So all of a sudden I have, let's just say I anticipated $2,000. I have $1,500 or $1,600 left over that I expected to give, expected that I had to pay to NIPSCO, but now it could be directed towards charity. Now, as soon as I say that, that sounds like bragging. I'm in two minds about that.
I think that's great. No, but that's, most people just pocket that, that they would think about that as money saved instead of that. I guess, is that the idea of the thank offering in the Old Testament?
I hope so. I'm sure maybe one of our listeners could correct us on that. But I just thought, as badly as I felt, I made myself feel more badly in thinking, what if I didn't have the money? If I had incurred this debt and didn't have the money, so it's much easier for me to give it away to people who don't have the money, who incur debts that they can't pay, and simply to know that that would be a cause of rejoicing to have a gift that expected no reciprocation simply because it was a sheer expression of gratitude. Now, I have to say, I'm not that good a person that this happens very frequently, but at least it happened once and it's enjoyable. So how does the psalm deal with the gift economy? There is a beautiful phrase in the psalm which is that that the way God works is like the eagle. Now, that doesn't seem to say much, except that, as Robert Alter points out, it's a weird phrase. And so we'll get to that. But the psalm is a celebration of what it means to participate in God's free economy and enjoying God's unreciprocated gifts. And as Luke makes clear, only if we have first benefited from the unmerited and unreciprocated generosity and forgiveness of healing and redemption, kindness and compassion, is it possible to actually desire to participate in God's free economy. To enjoy God's generosity, not only in receiving, but in passing it on. This giving without reciprocity will renew our youth like an eagle. All right, that is an obscure phrase. Renew your youth like an eagle. And I said Robert Alter then says it's a kind of a figure of speech. And what it actually means is the strange phrase youth like an eagle is a figure of speech that, quote, alludes to the eagle shedding its feathers and growing new ones. You see, participating in God's gift economy is like an eagle's shedding of its feathers. And if the eagle had language, would it say, I don't really want to shed these feathers because I'm not sure the old growth is going to be replaced by a new growth. But that's in fact what takes place. That somehow this youthfulness of the eagle is exemplified in that the old feathers are shed off and that allows new ones to grow. And that becomes the picture the psalmist gives to us of the gift economy in which we, yes, there is a generosity, but it's not grudging. It is understood that this is after having enjoyed God's love in this way, that it is renewing. It is something which is enlivening. It is vital. And only if one has had that experience is it possible to see generosity not as losing something, or it's losing old things so that something new can take its place. And so from that point on, those schooled by the Psalms, every time that they would see an eagle, would see the beauty of this gift economy as it was manifested in the flight of the eagle. So the psalmist celebrates the surprising realization that active participation in God's free economy does not leave us crabby, empty, and resentful. Although I have to say, there's a lot of crabbiness, emptiness, and resentment within the church. So something has gone wrong. But according to the psalm, it rather fills us with the fullness of youth that is exhibited in the flight of the eagle. Now, again, if we're just celebrating this gift economy, there is no better moment, I think, in the Old Testament. I have been for years and years attracted to this moment of reconciliation between Joseph's brothers and Joseph. And where Joseph says to them the words, I am your brother, and they don't know what to do with it. At first, Scripture says that they were terrified, and that terror stuck with them all the way to the end, where they just could not believe that Joseph had actually forgiven them. But in this passage, when Joseph forgives his brothers, that one act of unreciprocated love, that one act of forgiveness, from that point on, defined the children of Israel. And Joseph defined what this group of people was in calling them children of Israel. That bond of the family would be the bond that held this nation together. He did it by distinguishing the children of Israel from the nation of Egypt. See, Joseph had two identities when he confronted his brother. Joseph was an Egyptian ruler whose job it was to enforce the law and to bring the unjust to punishment. But Joseph wasn't only an Egyptian ruler. He was the lost brother. And the moment that he said to his brothers, I am your brother, he declared what identity would win out. It wasn't justice. It was mercy. It was the bond that God had established in the covenant. So which of these identities would determine his relationship with his criminal brothers was the question. And the brothers fully expected that in this world, criminal behavior gets punished with a criminal response or with a just response. But as ruler, Joseph could have enforced the law against his criminal and cowardly brothers. But instead, he chose to be the brother and love his enemy by forgiveness. Now, we go to the cross in which we see that this acted, but here that you see the cross already anticipated in Joseph's mercy. And the moment he absolved his brothers, now we make believe that absolution is just this kind of ethereal thing that has no consequence. But the moment Joseph absolved his brothers, the moment mercy triumphed over justice, the children of Israel were solidified by this act of forgiveness. It was that transaction of forgiveness, of absolution, that changed the whole of history from that point on. And that whole of history was changed because Joseph participated, freely chose to participate in God's free economy of forgiveness. And that same act of unmerited forgiveness would be bestowed on David. And eventually it would be come to fruition in Jesus's forgiveness of his enemies on the cross. And it looks like this forgiveness isn't an otherworldly and irrelevant thing, when in fact we have three examples here in which the impossible love of the enemy changed the world and changed it for the better.
And in this gift economy, it doesn't just stop at forgiveness. When looking at Joseph and his brothers, he forgives them and then beyond that provides everything that they'll need. That he gives them the whole land of Goshen that they're given, and all of the flocks, and that they're giving life. They're given forgiveness and then life beyond that forgiveness.
Absolutely. That forgiveness isn't the end of something. It's not the ceiling. The forgiveness is the floor, the foundation from which all sorts of things, as Luke, you know, showed that Jesus said, you know, all sorts of things, that once that foundation is there, then the ceiling is limited because it's eternal. You're right. I mean, that's how God intended to take care of people during the famine. And that's what Joseph said. He said, you meant it for evil, but God meant it to take care of, you know, all of the very many people who would not have the resources. And it had to begin as an act there was no cost benefit. It was just simply an act of love. So Paul takes this further, and as last week we dealt with that Paul anchors all of this hopefulness and patience and love in the resurrection. He continues in this chapter in just saying that you know, forgiveness is not the ceiling. Forgiveness is the foundation of our life because Jesus is the first fruits. What we saw on the cross and resurrection is not the ceiling of things. It is the foundation of the church's work in this world, and becoming a church that is truly Catholic, outreaching to all people everywhere and for all time. So Paul says, you know, God's free economy, this free organization, it doesn't work like the world. But the world economy is coming to an end. The world of calculated cost and benefits, it is not going to be able to deal with the people and the things that God's economy has targeted and aimed. So, I mean, we shouldn't ever lose sight of the fact that God's gracious economy is outrageous. It is not predictable. It is not something for the faint-hearted. It is something that is audacious in its outreach for all people everywhere and all time. Grace is not this thing which makes us comfortable. It's the opposite. It's an igniting fire that remarkable in what it does. So this economy, Paul says it works not according to cost and benefit, but it works. It's at work in the world. It is what happens with fruit and fruitfulness. The economy of fruit, as Paul says earlier in the chapter, begins with an outrageous trust that the tiny seed, against all visible evidence, that the tiny seed is filled with an invisible vitality that overcomes all sorts of resistance and finally bears fruit. Ridiculous, except that we all eat fruit. We all experience fruitfulness. And this is what Paul says. You can see it all around you. This is how God's economy works. You plant that seed not knowing how it's going to turn out. And amazingly, it does turn out just fine. No, not just fine, with fruitfulness. So we trust seeds because we have no choice. But God will not force us to live by grace. He does not force us to love our enemy. That is only something that the single individual can choose because they themselves have benefited from Christ's costly love given to them without calculation and without expectation of return. Only if the single individual has enjoyed the fruits of forgiveness and compassion is it possible to desire to want to live in this gift economy. Now, Christ is the first fruit, Paul says, which means that we can expect that this Catholic outreach will bear fruit whenever God wants in his time and among the people that he chooses and in all places. I know there's a lot of hand-wringing these days because church organizations are perishing. But sometimes that has to happen. God didn't promise to keep external organizations going. God promised to keep hope alive and promise alive and that his presence would be alive. And so rather than wringing our hands, it's just that now is a matter of trusting the fact that, as Paul says, that the first fruit has already been given. The rest is going to take place in God's timing. And Paul is quite clear that this grace, living by this grace, is a love that abolishes all temporary rules and authority. In other words, the restraints no longer obtain. They no longer are limiting. The only thing that limits us is God's desire to reach all the world through us. And so our task is not to worry about outcomes. Our task is not to worry about consequences of what we do. Ours is only to joyfully participate in Christ's economy that may seem out of touch with this world, but in fact, it is the very future of the world.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Go to the App Store or Google Play and get the one that is right for you for free. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other programs on our schedule, write me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. David and I will be back next week at this same time. Stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.